Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to buy Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. I'm your host, Brady Swenson. Swan Signal Podcast is an audio archive of our Swan Signal live broadcasts. Every week, we host a hangout with a group of Bitcoiners live on the Swan Twitter account to chat about the latest Bitcoin news and muse about a Bitcoin future. In this episode of Swan Signal, we're joined by Pierre Rochard, co-founder of the Nakamoto Institute and co-host of the Noted podcast, also Bitcoin evangelist at Kraken, and Francis Puglio, founder and CEO at Bull Bitcoin. In this episode, we try to settle a Twitter debate between Pierre and Francis about the value of the stock-to-flow model. We polled our Telegram chat room before and after the debate, and there was a clear winner. We delve into several other topics as well, including various hyper-Bitcoinization scenarios. This is a weekly highlight for us at Swan, and we're happy to be able to share it with you all. Here we go. All right, I think we are live. This is Swan Signal Live, April 1st, 2020. We've got Pierre Rochard and Francis Puglio with us this week. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Yeah, my pleasure.
Absolutely. All right. So this has been kind of a recent debate between you guys. I think Francis came out that he's anti-stock-to-flow model. Pierre has kind of been pushing back that it's actually useful. So I thought it'd be fun to have a little debate here. I know Pierre and I were both high school debaters. So we're going to formalize this thing and hash it out live right here. We're going to do a poll in the Telegram chat room. I'm going to put it in there as soon as we start, and we're going to get some opinions from the team or from the people in the chat before the debate, and then again after, to see if you guys can change minds. We're going to do two rounds of up to 3 minutes each for you both. So I flipped a coin. Pierre's going to go first, up to 3 minutes, and then Francis, then Pierre again, then Francis. I'll run a timer and let you guys know when your time's up. The question at hand is the stock-to-flow model a valuable tool for predicting Bitcoin's USD price? Pierre, take it away, man.
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of nooks and crannies in this one. So I think that we should start with just like an explanation of what it is. The stock-to-flow concept, as far as I understand it, was known about before Saifedean's book, The Bitcoin Standard. But he really was the one who popularized it and applied it to Bitcoin. I think that it had been mostly like among gold bug circles that stock-to-flow was discussed. But basically, the idea is that there's a ratio between the amount of above-ground gold that exists, so that's the stock, and then the amount of new gold that is being mined, so that's the flow that's kind of being added to this above-ground stock, because there's actually there's very little flow out, so there's of people losing gold or of gold being destroyed. I don't even know that you could actually do that chemically, but used for industrial purposes, and then it's not economical to recycle it, and so it ends up in a landfill. So that'll probably be the flow out. But in any case, so we can apply this concept to Bitcoin as well. So it's funny because there's a school of thought that all the Bitcoin already exist. So all of 21 million right. Bitcoin exists. So there is no stock to flow ratio for Bitcoin, or it's infinite. So that's one way to think about it, and we can discuss that because I think that it's an interesting thesis. But I think that the more moderate mainstream Bitcoiner view is that there is a Bitcoin stock to flow ratio, which is that so like with the Genesis block, you had a flow of 50 Bitcoin and a stock of zero. And then with the second block, you had a stock of 50 Bitcoin and then a flow of 50 Bitcoin. And so the ratio started at one. And then the ratio goes up. So the way to think about it is the higher ratio implies that there's more hardness or scarcity in the sense that the amount of above ground Bitcoin is much greater than the number of Bitcoin being mined and put into the market that way. Now, there's also a debate about whether that actually is the flow. So, like, some people argue that You know, if you look at an exchange, like the volume is going to have a lot more buyers and sellers than just miners. And so from their point of view, the flow doesn't make sense as being a meaningful part of the puzzle, and we can dig into that. And then the other part is that Bitcoin miners don't just get new Bitcoin. They don't just get the block subsidy. They also get transaction fees. And so another point of view is that as Bitcoin's block reward gets phased out, and presumably Bitcoin's transaction fees are going to go up and be a much more meaningful part of miner revenue, then this stock to flow ratio stops making as much sense because miners are still in this scenario forced sellers of Bitcoin, but transactors are forced buyers of Bitcoin in the sense that they have to acquire Bitcoin to pay the transaction fee when they're sending Bitcoin, which is a bit of a mouthful. But
all right, so that's, Pierre.
Yeah,
that's your intro. You want to finish it up with a few sentences?
Okay. I don't think that Francis and I disagree on any of that, right? I don't know that it should count towards my time. I'm just providing.
Oh, fair enough. You're laying
background. Yeah, out the conceptual.
I agree with that. I agree with that.
Okay. There's all right.
That's just the intro. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Very. Thanks. You want to start?
So we can get into the model now. So we have this stock to flow ratio that is changing over time, right? So it's increasing over time, and then that's one input for the model, and then the other input for the model is Bitcoin's price, which has also been increasing over time, and so also changing. And subsequent to Saifedean's publication of the Bitcoin standard last year, there was was it 2018? In any case, at some point over the past 18 months, a pseudonymous quant called Plan B came out with a Medium post, basically highlighting that he found a correlation between Bitcoin's price and Bitcoin's stock to flow ratio, which at first glance should not be surprising because both numbers have been going up, right? So while there might be a correlation, wouldn't be particularly interesting because you could also find a correlation between the number of days since Bitcoin was created and its price, or the number of days since Bitcoin was created and its stock to flow, especially because Bitcoin stock to flow is based on time, right? And it's that's why we have a difficulty adjustment in the halving. But there was a lot of discussion back and forth, and then other quants came in to take a look at it, and they started applying. And I'm not a quant myself, so I don't really know anything about statistics. I'm just regurgitating stuff that I read on the internet. Started applying different tests to it. To see if it was a spurious correlation or not, or more precisely to see what the likelihood that this was a spurious correlation or not. And basically, it seems like it's very unlikely that this is a spurious correlation. What that means is that it's very likely that there might be a causal relationship between these two factors of Bitcoin stock to flow ratio and the price, which makes sense if we take it in the context of Saifedean's book or just the concept of stock to flow itself, that if we think that Bitcoin's hardness is something that drives demand for it, then we would expect there to be some relationship between it. And that's probably where Francis and I start disagreeing.
All right, awesome. Francis, you have the floor.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll start off by saying what I think the stock to flow model is useful for. Because, and you know, the stock to flow model itself is not, we need to define what we're talking about. Like, I think the debate we're having is about Plan B's specific stock to flow to price correlation model, which is, in my mind, used more as a trading indicator than it's used as a trading indicator to see when to buy or when to not buy, and kind of like the Mayer multiple is being used as that kind of indicator right now. But the stock to flow concept is very useful to compare different types of currencies. And imagining that you're trying to determine which is the currency that is going to become the global reserve currency and global unit of account, and you want to compare different currencies and you want to have some kind of objective metric, the stock to flow is concept is really powerful, right? So the thing that makes Bitcoin extremely powerful, and which the stock to flow ratio reveals, is that the stock to flow ratio goes up predictably over time, and there's nothing on earth you can do that is going to change that. So the stock to flow ratio, you can kind of see it as the property of currencies to maintain their scarcity over time, and have that relative scarcity increase over time. So the main difference between gold, for example, and Bitcoin is that the stock to flow ratio of gold will change depending on the market price of gold, right? So if the stock, if the price of gold goes up significantly, people are going to start to mine more gold and introduce more gold to the market, which is going to bring back to an equilibrium, whereas the stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin is not going to change depending on the Bitcoin price. So this is what is useful. This is why it's useful. It's more as an illustration, an explanation of this concept, specifically regarding precious metals and other currencies that are considered to be some money or scarce. So that's something that's useful when explaining the difference between gold and Bitcoin. And now, I think just from a praxeology kind of point of view, there's two points that for me I want to make regarding the stock to flow model. The first one is that the stock to flow ratio is equivalent to time. That's it, right? So since the stock to flow ratio is predictable over time, right? So every 10 minutes, the stock to flow ratio will change by a certain amount based on time. And it's time. It's the same as time. And it's also the same as time, but having a modification of the time intervals that you're using every 4 years to make that time like twice as fast, right? So let's say that you're doing a regular price over a moving average kind of indicator, and you're choosing time intervals. Well, using the stock to flow ratio to me is the same as just using time intervals, but a specific time interval, which is like 10 minutes, you know, the block time, and having also the time intervals sped up every 4 years by twice. So that's the kind of the first basis is like it's time. And then the second basis is, well, if you're buying into the idea, and you know, of course, I think the scarcity of Bitcoin drives demand, but the scarcity of Bitcoin doesn't change over time. The fact that the stock to flow ratio changes doesn't change the fact that the stock to flow ratio is known in advance by everyone, right? So it's not as if, think about it for yourself. Like, do you value Bitcoin yourself more, twice as much, since there's, you know, the stock to flow ratio increased by 2x? I mean, not really, because when I bought Bitcoin, I knew, I saw the curve, and I saw the logarithmic issuance of the Bitcoin units, and I understood right away, it's not more scarce to me now than it was 2 years ago. That scarcity is something that only affects you once. Presumably, so the idea is, okay, so does the decreasing supply of Bitcoin increase demand proportionally? I guess this is the debate. And I think no. I think the correlation is interesting. Although, you know, a lot of people are throwing out correlation and cointegration, but it is a very, very small time series. We only had two halvings, right? It's not like, oh, we had like 10 years, so the correlation is great. Well, no, I mean, what we're really trying to correlate here is the movement of price with halvings, and we've only had two. So you got two real points in our data set here. So
yeah,
I think we should really take that with a grain of salt. And kind of the final point. Yeah. So that's it. S2F ratio is time, and what changes the Bitcoin price is demand. And I don't think that other than the marketing aspect of the halving, I don't think there's any correlation between the halving and the demand for Bitcoin.
Okay. I gave Francis a couple extra minutes there. I think 3 minutes was too short a time to give you guys. So, all right. What's your rebuttal, Pierre?
Yeah. So I don't think the S2F ratio is time, because there's a function there, right? So there's other variables in the function than time. If it was time, then if with each block you would expect the change in the S2F ratio to be the same, right? And so to increase linearly, which is what time does. Whereas Bitcoin's S2F ratio does not increase linearly. It has not only the halvings, obviously, but also just because it has, even without the halvings, if it was like 50 Bitcoin every 10 minutes forever, the stock to flow ratio like would still be nonlinear in the sense that it would be getting the amount of flow would be getting smaller and smaller relative to the stock. It wouldn't be staying the same. If we had like 1% inflation, right, where so then the stock to flow ratio would be linear over time, then I would agree that that the time and stock to flow are interchangeable in a model. And we can see this too, because there is no co-integration between price and time, but there is between price and stock to flow. So that, you know, from a quantitative perspective, kind of proves out that the stock to flow and time are not interchangeable. What was the second part, Francis?
The decrease in supply doesn't generate demand proportionally to time.
Oh yeah. So that's where I think that we can no longer rely on quantitative analysis, and we have to go on to go back to qualitative analysis, because I think that's where this started and that's where it should end. I think that there's a lot of different feedback loops that are occurring simultaneously. And so I think that in terms of the causality, that it's a lot of indirect causality. And there isn't like a direct causal mechanism, and that from a like, okay, well, what does that say about the model? I think that's reflected in the error bounds that the model has. And so, Francis mentioned people using this as a trading signal, and that's where I think that like that's a terrible idea, because the range of price movements that you get in this model is so wide that you could very easily get caught upside down in a trade, because even if you're like one standard deviation below or above the expected the forecasted price by the stock to flow model, the price can still go further out before mean reverting for a very long time. So that's where I think that the recommendation remains: buy and hold Bitcoin, and don't try to time the market. And so that, to me, that it's more about the kind of a long term. When people ask me, okay, well, where do you think this is going to go long term? In terms of okay. I have my qualitative analysis on that. In terms of quantitative analysis, which is often what some non-Austrians want to hear, the best model is S2F, and there isn't really even a number two alternative that we could point to. Now, there was another remark that I wanted to touch on. It escapes me now, so I'll just hand it back to Francis.
All right, wrap it up, Francis, and then we'll we'll ask the poll again in Telegram.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the general idea, my general understanding of the S2F model is, like, first and foremost, to reiterate, it's really useful to compare different currencies, maintaining their scarcity over time. So it makes it's a very nice illustrative conceptual tool. But I think there's a deeper kind of underlying aspect to this debate, which is what is, you know, ultimately is the halving priced in, right? I think, like, we can also distill that to some degree. Is the halving priced in, and does the halving happening generate more demand for Bitcoin on the market than there was? And I agree that, you know, a good heuristic is if you look at the two past halvings, you know, the bubble, the top of the bubble happened like 18 months later in both cases. So there's definitely this kind of correlation there that's real. And it's hard to disprove the S2F model as the S2F price prediction model, because you've got these very two potent and powerful examples. However, I think that what drives the demand, and there's a point that Pierre touched on, which we actually should drive on just a little bit, which is, I don't know how many Bitcoins are actually in circulation being traded on the exchanges. You know, I've never really looked at the data. I've never done like chain analysis data, but say that out of the 18 million Bitcoins that are out there, just my intuition, like my basic intuition is that there's like 6 million up for grabs, right? Maybe 6 to 7 that are up for grabs. And I'm pulling these numbers out of my butt completely, right? It's just kind of intuition. And I would assume, just based on the trading volumes, that you got like maybe 3-4 that are like tradable, that are actually like traded more than like once a year, like on exchanges. So if you consider the actual stock to flow ratio being more the Bitcoins that are liquid and available on the market rather than the Bitcoins that have been mined, then the model kind of falls apart, right? So that's enough. So there's like, you need to accept the idea that the scarcity of Bitcoin is the on paper, well, not on paper, but the actual amount of Bitcoins that are out there and not the actual amount of Bitcoins that are available for purchase on the exchanges. You know, I think the halving definitely has a huge marketing aspect to it that might generate some demand, but I'm less and less convinced that the supply shock of the halving has a massive effect on the price. I think I wanted to share my screen. I've been thinking about the adoption curve of Bitcoin, and I see it as being. I can't share my screen. Like, I was trying to.
Okay.
See,
gotcha.
I drew this chart out. I was like, a couple days ago, I was super hungry and tired, and I just kind of like kept hallucinating this shape in my head, which is an S curve that's also a logarithmic curve. I've been thinking a lot about Pierre's speculative attack article, thinking about the Canadian dollar, thinking about people exiting shitty currencies for better currencies. And I think that, you know, the actual model of how Bitcoin adoption is going to happen is much closer to Pierre's speculative article, which is at some point people are not going to buy Bitcoin because they see it as scarce. They're going to buy Bitcoin just because they need it to pay their rent, and that's going to be more the same dynamic. They're not going to opt in of Bitcoin. They're going to opt out of fiat and grab. Oh, I think I got cut off there. But so I think people are not going to opt into Bitcoin because it becomes more scarce. I think they're going to gradually opt out of the various fiat currencies because they become less scarce. And I think that's more the dynamic. So the reason why I'm so kind of aggro with the S2F model, and I didn't want to be, I mean, I don't like to be caught in these like debates. It's just, I really have this really strong disdain for econometrics in generally speaking. So the idea that the economists can basically predict how people are going to react how people are going to act in the future based on mathematical models. So, you know, if you increase the inflation rate, if you do this and that, people are going to go to work, people are going to do this. I have like an inherent, like, visceral kind of like aversion to that. That's number one. And the number two is also because I don't want people to have expectations when they get into Bitcoin that are based on, oh, well, you know, I thought that this shit was supposed to go up this way. The price was supposed to go up this way, and it's not going up that way as I thought. I just think we should be like really, really careful with setting up expectations, because as we saw with the COVID crisis, you know, stuff like that can happen really quickly. Black swans can happen, and then the whole model goes out the window. The price of Bitcoin could have mooned, you know, to $100,000 right now, and we'd be like, oh crap, like we're 2 years ahead of the schedule on the SOF model. Shit, I should have bought more. Or the price could stay extremely low in Bitcoin because of market manipulation. It could stay extremely low for the next 2-3 years. Until the central banks and the banks run out of money to suppress the Bitcoin price, who knows? So if you're going to, any model that you have should be, in my mind, more praxeologic. So just based on logic, really, and be not affected by the by black swans, essentially.
All right, man. Thank you very much. I think that was a great takes from both of you.
There's a side argument that
I was about to
comes
ask
off
you
the
you
SUF
thought.
Quite a lot, which is how should you think about this supply after the halving? And basically, you know, the two sides are, okay, well, new supply just got chopped in half, but then everybody who trades a lot says, well, there's actually plenty of supply every day. It's the, you know, 3 million coins that are regularly trading, and so it's just a drop in the bucket when you drop that new supply, you know, reduction into that larger equation. So how do you guys think about how to define the supply of Bitcoin available?
Yeah, I think that the part of what causes more demand after a halving, and actually I was reminded of what I was wanting to disagree with Francis on, is the amount of data that goes into the model. I actually think that the halvings are kind of the big events that, you know, we do focus on a lot, but the time between the halvings is actually also part of the model. And so S2F is increasing during those times, obviously not as much as a stepwise function as the halvings. But if for example we saw that the correlation held during or only in the 18 months after halving, and then the correlation didn't work, you know, for the other, so it's every 4 years, so subtract 18 months from 4 years, and that's 2.5 years, right? So if the correlation broke down for 2.5 years out of four, we would see that, and because every day is part of the data. And so I would dispute the amount of data that is going into the model. Although there's also a lot of different ways people have done the model. And so I don't necessarily think that like Plan B's like is the model, because it's subjective. Like anyone can put together the model any way they want. So whether it's by a day or week or month or year. So on the demand side, one thesis that I found particularly interesting was Bitcoin as a Veblen good, which is that normally you would expect that an increase in the price of a good suppresses demand. So fewer people want that good because it is more expensive now. And thus the number of people whose subjective wants are fulfilled by that good is decreased when you take into account the cost of acquiring that good. And with a Veblen good, you actually have the opposite, which is a little counterintuitive, which is the higher the price is, the more people are interested in it. And you can kind of see this in like luxury goods. You know, the higher the price of a sports car is, it might attract more buyers rather than fewer. And I do think that this is a very plausible indirect causal mechanism that is a piece of the puzzle here. Not the entire puzzle, but one piece of it. And that it's a chicken and egg thing, right? So why did the price go up? Well, because the price went up, because demand went up, because the price went up. So what I think undoes the chicken and egg chain is the supply drop. So because miners are constantly selling Bitcoin to either refresh their hardware or to pay their electricity bill and their rent, if that gets cut in half, obviously it doesn't get cut in half on the day of the halving, but you know, in the months after the halving, you have a marginal decrease of Bitcoins coming onto the market that can cause the price to start drifting up, and then you kick in the feedback loop of the Veblen good until the price completely overshoots demand, like it did, you know, in December 2017. It's going parabolic because you have not only the Veblen good from let's call them monetary users, savers, right? People, the hodlers of last resort, being magnetically attracted to this Veblen good. You also have the short-term momentum traders layered on top of that. And so I think that you go from miners selling less to Bitcoin hodlers of last resort buying more to short-term traders buying more. And then they're leveraged. They overextend themselves. They overleverage, and that's the top. And then you have a cascade of liquidation down, you know, the chain until finally you find a bottom. Maybe that bottom is set by the buyers of last resort, which is an article that I wrote as well.
Yeah, so in regards to Corey's question, like how should we perceive the supply? I mean, it's a good point because, I was just doing some quick math on my phone there, and, you know, the supply of Bitcoin that's reduced per year with the halving is like 350,000. There's like 350,000 less Bitcoins that are issued per year. And if you look at it, like BitMEX is like all-time trading days volume, BitMEX has like 1 million Bitcoin, you know, equivalent trading volume in a day. I mean, obviously we all know that that's not actual Bitcoins being traded. It's extremely highly leveraged, you know, derivatives that are being traded there. But you have these exchanges that are sometime doing, you know, 10 billion in a day, whereas the halving is like three something at current price, like three something billion less supply on the market. So I think we have a lot of academic debates that have as a premise that Bitcoin is widely adopted and it's kind of liquid, right? Because as we know, some guy dropping, like imagine some guy drops or some person drops 25,000 Bitcoins on three different markets right now. I mean, sorry, we're all getting Martin called, you know, the price is going to $2,000, you know, and it's, you get a flash crash, that person's going to get personally wrecked, but I mean, it is going to cause a flash crash, and that flash crash might actually not go back to the actual price of Bitcoin for a little while. I think the actual price of Bitcoin is the floor at which people, it's not even the floor at which people are not willing to sell, it's the amount of Bitcoins that are held by people who never sell. That's like the floor of Bitcoin, and I think that's something that that increases maybe with other events than the halving. For example, I think the No2x UASF scenario caused a large proportion of the Bitcoin holders to mentally lock in their entire stash as, okay, after this, I'm not ever selling again. And now you have these external factors like the possibility of a bail-in or a bank account seizure. And you have, okay, so a lot of the casual midterm momentum Bitcoin traders are like, well, I was never planning on I don't believe in this thing like long-term as being a global monetary reserve, but for the next 5 years, I don't want to sell the Bitcoins. Because if you think about also the what Kerry was talking about, that the Veblen goods, or I don't know what the actual term was, but that the price of certain goods going up over time creates more demand over time. I mean, that obviously applies to monetary goods, right? If you have you look at Mises's a regression theorem, which is I guess the underlying economic theory behind Bitcoin, which is that the value of money goods, monetary goods, is not based on their utility, it's based on people's expectation that it's going to maintain its purchasing power over time. Well, a cool thing about purchasing power is that it needs to be executable for it to be purchasing power. Theoretical purchasing power doesn't matter, right? So if you have, you know, $10 million worth of bank stock, you can't execute that and buy, you know, three huge mansions. You can't, right? Because you're not, you might be physically prevented from selling that bank stock for currency that makes you able to purchase whatever you want to purchase. And also that people's purchasing power right now is still priced in US dollars. So when you're thinking, oh, my purchasing power is increasing every year with Bitcoin, next year I'll be able to buy twice as much more stuff. Well, most people are thinking about it in US dollar terms or fiat currency terms. Like, oh, I have, you know, one Bitcoin, it's worth 10 grand. Next year or in the future, I'm assuming, I'm speculating it might be worth 20 grand or 30 grand. So that's kind of a strange thing, is we're still pricing it in fiat currency terms, whereas, you know, you still have to take into account that if the fiat currency value drops like 10x, then the price of Bitcoin, you know, if it maintains its purchasing power, hasn't dropped 10x, hasn't increased 10x. And in these crazy volatile markets that are completely manipulated, it might take like decades for all of these different factors to come into an equilibrium. So like to conclude, I don't think there's anything like very dangerously wrong with the SOF model, because it is a good analytical tool. I just think that ultimately the point is number go up over time, and that's really it. And it doesn't really, the time frame doesn't really matter, because I see it as being like 0 to 100, right? So Bitcoin's going to go. I think hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen in two phases. This is kind of like going off topic, but you know, after really thinking about it, there's a point I also want to make, is hyper-Bitcoinization was theorized initially as being this kind of one-time event that's going to be extremely fast. We're talking about like a few years or even less than a few years. And then we're going from no fiat to a fiat to the no fiat economy. But what I realize is that not everyone is going to be able to partake in hyper-Bitcoinization, because everyone's going to be broke. And you can't acquire Bitcoin if you're broke, right? And you certainly can't acquire Bitcoin if you don't have a job and you're not getting, you know, paid for your labor. So I think hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen in two phases. The first phase is going to be the people who have liquid assets that are able to transform them into Bitcoin before those assets lose value. And then you're going to have this plateau where people are going to start to be paid in Bitcoin instead of being paid in fiat and buy Bitcoin. And then the time it's going to take for people to adopt Bitcoin is going to be just proportional to the time it takes for them to get paid, right? So it's going to be much slower process. And these are things that, you know, are going to be unpredictable regardless of the what's in Bitcoin, you know, the halvings, the supply. All it takes is for some outside event to cause some trouble for all of our predictions to go away. So I guess, you know, just be ready for anything, right? Don't expect the expected.
Yeah, but like you said earlier, you know, even if that does happen, these kind of black swan events, and it really disrupts the kind of flow of and the adoption of Bitcoin and the price appreciation of Bitcoin, It'll eventually revert back to the mean, but maybe it'll take years to do so, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think markets are much slower to markets are much slower than we think, right? Because the markets that are quick, that we see the market adjustments that are quick, it's all on paper money that's being traded, right? The average person's behavior in the marketplace is going to take years and years and years. I mean, you see how fast things have changed, you know, in terms of intellectually, right? How fast it has changed with the economy and monetary policy. But if you look at the average person's behavior, nothing has changed over the past month and a half, right? People are kind of still in the same kind of numbness. I think it's going to take like many years for people's day-to-day behaviors to change.
So Pierre, what do you think about Francis's idea about hyper-Bitcoinization happening in two phases? I know you've thought a lot about this concept.
Yeah, I mean, maybe people will have money because the government gives it to them, and so maybe it'll change the dynamic. But I do think that historically, if you look at cases of you know, financial panics or of hyperinflations, it generates a lot of short-term inequality because. I think it's Nassim Taleb who said like markets are like a big theater with a very small entrance and exit. And so whoever is seated closest to the entrance or the exit, they're the ones that are, it's kind of the same concept as the Cantillon effect for that matter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, you know, the ones that are closest to the door are disproportionately benefit compared to everyone else who kind of gets stuck behind. That's why we don't want things like this to happen. And it's terrible that the Keynesians forced this on us and on human civilization. But that part's a little bit out of our control. On the note of like exchange volumes, I do agree. I think that they don't matter in the sense of they're like zero sum. And so they do set the price in the very short term. But then as we look longer term, you know, it's like Unchained Capital had the HODL waves of, you know, how long since the UTXO last moved. That to me is the real demand side. And then the real supply side is the miners creating new Bitcoin. And that's kind of what sets the baseline value. And what's going on exchanges day to day is really... I mean, it's a battle between market makers and bots. Like, there's not the bots are not thinking about economic fundamentals or anything like that. They're jockeying in the order book and you know, they're trying to scalp and make a short-term profit. And often, you know, they're looking for dollar-denominated profits. They're not even looking for Bitcoin-denominated profits, which, as we know, is a big mistake. Big mistake. I do agree with the point of expect the unexpected. Like I've theorized about how hyper Bitcoinization is going to happen. It feels like every year I get a new idea about how I might be wrong or how it might actually happen. One that Saifedean brought up that I found really interesting was this idea of like. It not being disruptive at all because you have the dollar demonetizing at the same rate that Bitcoin is monetizing. So there's actually a pretty organic and seamless transfer over because debt would be getting destroyed rather than created, which was actually my speculative attack thesis, is that dollar-denominated debt would get created to buy Bitcoin. And thus, you know, devalue the dollar. I still stick by my speculative attack article, mostly out of nostalgia and ego. But if it happens otherwise, I won't be disappointed that I was wrong on this.
Well, why do you Sorry, let me gather my thoughts. So the Plan B's stock to flow model is, you know, really made possible by the 4-year cycle, right? Like if we had a linear, emission curve. There probably wouldn't be a co-integration between stock to flow and price, I would imagine. Why?
I disagree on that.
You do? Okay. Well,
yeah.
Address that and then maybe answer the question, like, why do you think Satoshi chose a four-year cycle?
So we can't know the counterfactual of what this would look like without the halvings. Go read Henry Hazlitt, Economics in One Lesson. But let's theorize here. Right. I think that if we had not had the halvings and instead we had a steady drip where with every block, the block subsidy was decreasing so that, from a scarcity perspective, we still get to a ceiling of 21 million Bitcoin over the same number of years. It's just smoothed out. I think that in terms of how that would affect the stock to flow model, it would affect the correlation parameters. So the specific number that makes the regression, I think would be different. I still think that the correlation would exist, and I still think that the co-integration would be there. Now I have no way of proving this, obviously.
Of course.
It's really theoretical. But the reason I think that is because the halvings are overrated in a sense of how much they affect, because in the earlier, what I was talking about in terms of the shock that the supply reduction has, you would still have, you wouldn't have the layer one shock of miners getting their output cut in half. Instead you would have a steady shock, right? So you would have miners steadily putting less coins into the market. But you would still have the top layer momentum traders who are the ones who are really, to me, causing the wave, and because they're the short-term price setters. And I also think that the Bitcoin's holders of last resort do get carried away in the euphoria as well. They're not immune to it either. I still think that we would have price waves. Like, I don't think that the price could just linearly go up. Then it kind of gets into a human psychology of how long does it take for the psychology to repair itself after the trauma of a bull and bear cycle. I don't think that the halvings, maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe the trauma would take longer to repair without the halvings, in the sense that you could have 10 years between peak to trough, which is usually what it is in the stock market, right? Mm-hmm. It is possible that the halvings are essentially providing a boost to psychology at the right time and are accelerating hyper-Bitcoinization faster than it would otherwise happen. But I still think it would otherwise happen.
Right. Do you think Satoshi intended that? Thought this through? I mean, there was so much that was intentional, in the protocol.
I think it was the simplicity of the engineering implementation is what was driving that. I think that it would be more complex to have every block have a reduction in the block reward. I could try my hand at programming that and then see maybe if it is as simple as what he did. But if you look at the halving function, it's pretty elegant. It's pretty concise. So I think there might be just an engineering argument for it. And not that he was like a mad genius extrapolating human psychology and thinking about the bull and bear cycle.
Some people think it has something to do with the presidential cycle too, because Bitcoin was launched in the midst of a presidential election, and to keep that going every 4 years. Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Francis?
It's a obviously we can't know what would have happened, as Pierre said, if there was no halving, the effect on the price and the correlation and stuff like that. And to some degree, it doesn't really matter, because depending on which stock to flow ratio model that you use, I think Plan B's specific one uses a 365-day moving average for the price. And there's one site that I'm looking at now that has a 10-day moving average, and the other one has a 365-day moving average. And, you know, the longer time interval that you take, the more smoothed out it is. So if we hadn't had any halvings at all, I think my intuition is that we would have probably had the same kind of spikes in the same kind of bubbles overall. Because the price discovery only really happens in those kind of lows, very lows and very highs, right? Because the huddler of last resort will not always be a huddler of last resort, right? When the main multiple hits like 7 or 6, right? Where, you know, the price right now compared to the moving average of the last 200 days or something like that is like, it's 7x what it was. A lot of the huddlers of last resort are like, well, you know, I'll sell and buy more Bitcoin in 3 months as is tradition.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's got that little number. Like, I'm never going to sell this 75%, yeah. But this 25%, if we go crazy, I'm going to, you know, take a little profit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Same with the bottom, right? At some point, the on paper price on the exchanges, it can go down to $2,000, for example. But I don't think it could stay there for long, right? I think I'm not doing financial analysis here, but I think the floor of six, you know, 500, 6 that we're seeing now, I mean, that is indicative that we might see happening in the near term. It's probably closer to the hunters of last resort stash or, you know, stock, I guess, that you have than another price. Regarding the, so I think the 4-year cycle is super interesting to try to figure out, like, why did he take 4 year? I agree with Pierre 100% that it's much easier to do these kind of halvings at a set period of time than to do it in every block. I think every block would have been a much more difficult challenge to implement. But why did he take 4 instead of 10 instead of 20? I think there's a trade-off to having more inflation in the beginning, which is that you're subsidizing the early adopters more, right? So it's kind of like, to which degree do I want to subsidize the early adopters more than the late adopters? And to which degree, like, what's the speed that we need for bootstrapping the network? And I think that perhaps one of the things that Satoshi was thinking about was, okay, I really need to incentivize people to work on this quickly, because we want Bitcoin is not going to stay low profile. And as soon as it hits high profile, it's going to get attacked, right? So this is why, for example, none of the altcoins have fair launches that are organic emergent adoption, because they need to kind of bootstrap their network in the beginning to resist these hash rate attacks. So Satoshi was probably aware of the fact that Bitcoin was not secure, was not going to be secure for a while, and that as soon as it hits kind of like mainstream adoption, it's going to be a big problem. People are going to get attacked. So he might have wanted to incentivize a very quick bootstrapping of the network with this, you know, hyperinflation of 50 Bitcoins per 10 minutes, essentially. So like one of the things that I always thought I would tell Satoshi was that, you know, if this is your logic, if your logic was to incentivize people to bootstrap the network early on by giving a disproportionate high reward in the first 4 years, instead of making it something more like a gradual, like halving potentially every 10 years, right? I think that halving is really cool, like that it's like the actual 2x down. Perhaps it could have been maybe 10 years instead of 4 years. And I would just say, like, people, I don't think were motivated by having a lot of Bitcoins early to bootstrap the network. I think there were the first 2 years, there was a much higher ideological motive than I want to have a lot of Bitcoins now motive, because as we saw, a lot of the early adopters that built the infrastructure actually sold off much of their coins, but then end up holding them in the long term. But it's the in politics, you know, people are used to having an attention. Most people think about politics only 3 months to 6 months every 4 years. And there seems to be some kind of Lindy effect or, you know, some kind of Nash equilibrium to that, because all the democracies tend to be around the 4 or 5 year mark. Might be something in our human psychology that's geared to that number. And then maybe Satoshi said, hey, there might be a reason why everything that's a governance change is 4 years. So
Makes sense. Yeah. Something to do with our you know, life expectancy or something. Corey, do you have any thoughts on the timing of the Bitcoin white paper network launch? You know, the context that it was launching.
Yeah, just thinking about, you know, was it accidental that the white paper was published in the middle of the depths of GFC one? Now that we're in GFC two, and I don't think it's a coincidence at all, because we know Satoshi had a lot of different interests and presumably was working on many different things. And this was something that was probably in progress for quite some time. And I think in watching the GFC rolling start, you had plenty of time to sort of watch it unfold. It was early 2007 that the cracks started to show. And you had people like Bill Gross from PIMCO putting out podcasts every day saying this thing's falling apart. And you had the Goldman distressed bank loan sales desk going from, you know, from long to short and all these different things. So like it was kind of predictable that something bad was happening. And, you know, I think that probably in 2008, when it really got going, you had, you know, Lehman in August of 2008. And you could imagine that that's when Satoshi, you know, sat down and was like, okay, I got to finish this thing, you know? And it was this urgency that made it come out. So it's not a coincidence in my mind that it came out when it did. It was, oh my God, I kind of need to do this, and this is the time that people are actually going to pay attention and actually care about this thing that I put out.
Yeah, I agree, and I think the most interesting part of the creation of Bitcoin was that the monetary policy is completely avoided in the white paper. There's no mention at all of any economic or monetary economics in there, and I think you're right, 100% right, Corey. He may have been thinking, okay, I need some help. I need some feedback right now. He might have been stuck on that problem for years, as far as we know. And my intuition, and this is like complete speculation out of nowhere, I don't know how I developed this idea, but I started to develop this idea that Satoshi may have wanted to have a linear, and there's no evidence of this at all, but I there's like an intuition in my mind that Hal Finney was the one that suggested the supply cap, and that when Satoshi launched a white paper, I generally don't remember how I got this idea. So like nobody should think that I have some information that I'm not sharing. I just got this feeling, and now it's just stuck with me. But I really had the feeling that Hal Finney was the one that got the idea in Satoshi's head to do the halving and the gold like. Stock to flow versus a linear kind of increase in the supply, because a linear increase in Bitcoin supply would have been still sound money, right? It still would have been pretty good sound money. But for some reason, it's just not as marketable. I don't know. It's just the marketing aspect of having this logarithmic curve is just so perfect. And I think that the Satoshi's engineering mind may have been geared more towards a linear curve, whereas I think Hal had a very deep, extremely economic mind. He may have been the one that suggested it. I like to think that, but I don't know.
All right, well, guys, it's April 1st. It's the dawn of Q2, you know, I hear both of you guys have plans to launch shitcoins this quarter. So I just wanted to hear about each take a turn and tell me about your particular shitcoin and if you've gotten names for it. You can also crowdsource the names for your shitcoins if you like. But it seems appropriate to talk about our new shitcoins on April 1st.
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead, Pierre. You can.
So I'm excited to announce WhoCoin. It's a coin that's going to finance the World Health Organization. It's mostly going to be focused on putting out the right messages, right? So masks don't work, and that China had nothing to do with this, and that we're all in this together. So WhoCoin, it's going to be launching today. You can buy it. And really what this token is going to enable, it's an entire new ecosystem, right? Where previous ecosystems, the scamming was kind of just focused on the token itself. But here we're going to really scam people on health, right? Which I think is also important, and really expand the grifting to cause as much human suffering as possible. So that's WhoCoin, and hopefully we'll see it on CoinMarketCap soon.
Yeah, definitely hit us up if you guys want to get in on the pre-sale. You know, we're going to be the first exchange to list WhoCoin, and we're selling it like super pre-mine on this one, like 80% pre-mine. It's going to be awesome.
Well, ironically, I am actually going to announce something. I was going to announce something today, but I realized that it was April 1st, so we decided to push it to tomorrow. And I hate to do like pre-announcements. I would just, if it was only me, I hate that I'm the one that's doing that. If it was only me, I would have just announced it already. But there's you know, two other partners in the project that I'm working on that, you know, you got to respect the marketing department's timelines. But generally speaking, we're going to be announcing a prepaid card product, prepaid product that makes it easier to buy Bitcoin. We're going to be announcing that tomorrow. So pretty excited to announce this project.
So that's actually real.
That's just
confirming that the announcement tomorrow will be real because it will happen on the second.
Yes.
Well, sticking with the theme. The theme of April 1st, Brady and I and Jan are really proud to announce that we're launching Swantron.com. So it's going to be the best way to stack suns. So yeah, lowest fees on stacking Tron. It's the future. Some friends of ours around the world are getting in on the game. So Ruben is launching Get Shitter over in Europe. So that's pretty cool. And And we also have Alex launching the Amber Crap over in Australia, also selling Tron on DCA. So that's pretty cool.
It's where everything's heading. It's definitely where everything's heading. Do we have any?
I did Litecoin announcement like 2 years ago on April 1st or something. I've already announced my shitcoin April Fool's thing a few years ago, I think.
Well, we have one question we can finish up on from the chat room. So this is a question about the future. It's really two questions, and it's kind of the optimistic question and the pessimistic version of the question. So in the future, in a Bitcoin future, how do we expect people, you know, I guess let's put it this way. How do we expect behavior to change in the positive and in the negative? Like, what will people do that's healthier and better for the community and human society in general? And like, what devious ways will humans find to cheat the system in a Bitcoin world?
I don't think there's any of the latter.
Nothing different there.
Well, I guess you could already point to existing trends, right? So ransomware is obviously a big negative that's enabled by Bitcoin. But that's all that comes to mind. I think that there's going to be a continuation of that and maybe an amplification, but ultimately that's going to cause more investment in what they call cybersecurity. So I guess that is something that should have been happening anyway, and thus is getting motivated by Bitcoin. But on the positive, like I think that the whole, and it's funny because this is something people complain about, the HODL meme, right? This is the strongest meme in the ecosystem by far. I don't think anyone would dispute that. And the reason why I think that's the case is because the economic fundamentals are there. And so it's a meme that has repeatedly gotten reinforced. And I think that it's only going to get more amplified and even bigger, to where essentially, you know, in the fiat system, savings holding cash really got a bad rap, and the pendulum swung in the direction of, you should be in a index fund for the stock market instead of holding cash. And I think the pendulum is going to swing to the other direction, and it's actually going to far overshoot. And but that's not a problem, because there's nothing wrong with savings and holding cash, just that it is going to overshoot. So I think that people are, for generations, going to be holding way more cash than, the equilibrium amount that they would rationally be holding. I put those in air quotes. This is good, because I really think that economists have been misunderstanding why holding cash is a good thing. And it really comes to a head when you have a crisis like we had with COVID-19, where basically the reason we hold cash is to hedge future cash flow uncertainty. And we don't know what that cash flow uncertainty is going to be. It can be good in the sense of an unexpected investment opportunity or an unexpected vacation with friends, right? Or it can be bad in the sense of losing your job, losing your income, and having your life disrupted that way, as we've seen with this quarantining stuff going on. So that's kind of at the microeconomic level, and I think that scales up to the macro level as well. And so when we don't hold enough cash as a society, we have a very fragile system. And when we hold lots of cash, we don't have to worry about things like price gouging, right? People complain about price gouging because they don't have the cash to pay that price. Not because there's anything inherently wrong with price gouging. In fact, that price gouging is a good thing, because it creates a profit motive to reallocate resources such that, we've got more masks or whatever the actual underlying good is. And so I really think that the pendulum swinging in the other direction is going to be fantastic for society, and we're going to get to debunk Keynesianism empirically, which is nice for a change.
I'm going to give just a quick real life example of what price gouging did that was actually great for America in this crisis. So a really good friend of mine has had a chemical plant with his dad for the last 20 years down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And their primary product for the last decade or so has been making a few ingredients for LCD screens, primarily exported to China. That dried up pretty significantly with the coronavirus rolling out. They quickly saw the ridiculous markups and just the lack of hand sanitizer all over the country, and had schools all over Texas and hospitals. He lives in New York most of the time. Hospitals throughout the New York area, and first responders, looking for sanitizer. And they took about 10 days to retool their plant, and they're supplying schools and first responders, hospitals throughout Connecticut, and just basically turned their whole factory into a hand sanitizer manufacturer. And there was enough margin in there to do that and become a wholesaler very quickly. So that I just think is a great real world example of that. And so then if you had the government, installing price controls, you would have the shortage and nobody supplying it. So there's one more topic we wanted to fit in, we've seen a few people commenting on, Bitcoin Core developers talking about are we ready for a massive influx and a massive increase in network activity and 10x users or 100x users over the next few years? And I just wanted to hear both of you guys talk a little bit about, cart before the horse, and can you really get the resources to build out the network and the infrastructure before the demand is there? Or does the demand kind of have to come first and then everybody rushes in to play catch up? How does that work? How has it worked historically, and how do you expect it to work over the next few years?
Francis, you go first.
In terms of the actual Bitcoin network, I think there's much more that core developers need to do to scale Bitcoin. Am I freezing right now? Is my, okay, my internet connection is really bad. So if I continue to freeze, just cut me off. But I don't think there's a lot that the Bitcoin Core developers need to do right now for the network. I mean, the kind of improvements that we're looking at are like Merkleized, you know, abstract syntax trees that make certain types of smart contracts more private, or so on and so forth. I mean, we're really at the optimization phase of the Bitcoin network. I think that's perfectly fine. I think that the bottleneck to adoption isn't like transaction speed or network speed or transaction throughput. I think it's definitely a UX UI challenge at the application layer, at the exchange layer, and at the custody layer. I think that's what's really the problem. As stupid as it sounds, the main bottleneck is how do we get people to safeguard their seeds and not lose their Bitcoins. I think that's the main issue still. If there is to be some kind of intermediary custodial model where, okay, some people can't be trusted to, I mean, some people don't trust themselves to hold their own to their Bitcoins. And I think the culture shift required for that to be like possible, like 100% custody over the network, we're talking about like a generation, right? Talking about like 20, 30 years before, I think, before there's like a global culture of responsibility and self-reliance that's instilled enough so that people will be very comfortable holding their own keys. And we're going to have, for example, like 90% of the Bitcoins out there are going to be in self-custody. I think if there was to be mass adoption right now, we would have like 5% of the Bitcoins be in self-custody. And that might be a problem. So I think this is like more the things that we're talking about. In terms of like Lightning Network, I think we have a few years left for it to be a very good mainstream and like a mainstream tool. I used to be much more bearish on Lightning, but I'm becoming more bullish on Lightning over time because I think a lot of the Lightning community has responded well to the challenges of UX UI on Lightning. For example, the UX challenges of invoices and be getting paid in Lightning is significantly more difficult than paying in Lightning, which had caused in the network an imbalance of cash flow between the people who are spending Lightning after having opened the channel and the people who had not opened channels and wanted to get paid in Lightning. I thought this caused an imbalance where the people who were receiving payments in Lightning had to basically close their channels or dump them to someone else. Because it had tears for those. So I think this is like super positive development. But I am definitely in the mindset that I don't want hyper-Bitcoinization to happen right now. From the point of view of someone which is like operating an exchange and operating services, I could definitely, and I mean, I'm not a huge company. We're a very small company despite our like big mouth. So if you're like a Coinbase and you're already extremely scaled, or a Kraken and you've scaled very well right now, you might say, hey, bring on hyper-Bitcoinization. You know, we've got the infrastructure. But there's not a lot of businesses out there that are physically ready for hyper-Bitcoinization. I think there might be like maybe 10 or 15 that are like well set up. And I think if there's, you know, hyper-Bitcoinization now, you're going to have a lot of centralization because not a lot of services are available to handle it. So I think we're getting out of the bootstrap phase of Bitcoin. I think we're, you know, there was the first phase, which was like the prototype phase. And then we had kind of like the bootstrap phase, which I think we're leaving now. And then I think we got maybe a couple of years before we get to the kind of like, maybe not acceleration phase, but the, you know, we're kind of leaving. I think we're still kind of, you know, Bitcoin is in beta-ish. You know, 2009 to 2000, let's call it, you know, 2012. You know, when we had that was maybe the alpha. And now we're kind of like ending the beta stage where, you know, I think when we have some of the main issues on Lightning resolved, we're going to be kind of in the product launch phase of Bitcoin, but we're not far. And the kind of issues that I'm talking about are issues that are solved relatively exponentially and quickly. So maybe if I had to decide when hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen, I would say we need a little more cultural awareness. to responsibility first, which I think we're kind of seeing a shift now towards that, because like the last 10 years have just been the golden age of millennialism. And I think people now that are finding themselves unemployed, numb, having no idea what to do, they need a few years, I think, to digest this new information about how the world is a dangerous place. And we also need a bit of infrastructure. So, you know, 2023 would be the ideal year for me. 2023, 2024. I have to choose a date.
We're coming up on time here. I want to respect you guys' time. I know you have lots of work to do. So, Pierre, do you want to make a few sentences here to wrap us up on that idea?
I agree with everything Francis just said. So I don't really have anything to add on that.
Okay. So the debate poll results. Before the debate, we had 11 votes. The yes answer agreeing with Pierre was 73%. The no answer agreeing with Francis, 27%. After the debate, we had 10 votes, so just one fewer. 40% agreed with Pierre and 60% agreed with Francis. So Francis, you flipped to the room. At least 10
Congratulations,
people.
Congratulations, Francis. Well done.
Oh!
Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Well, as you guys know, we said this on Twitter yesterday, YouTube banned our account for posting this event before we even held the event. Have no idea why. The title of the event was completely innocuous. So I know today the YouTube censors are watching. They're completely disappointed in both of you. They were obviously expecting a lot of violence and toxicity. You guys were way too civil and polite. You know, I appreciate that, but the YouTube censor is obviously very disappointed. So, you know,
nice.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, guys. Really appreciate your time.
I want to see one thing happen, and this is obviously an ongoing meme on Twitter. I want to hear Francis say, "I am Pierre Rochard," and vice versa.
Yes, me and Pierre are basically the same person. Actually, I don't know if a few people saw that or didn't see that, but it turns out that Pierre and I are actually from a very close geographic. We're very close geographically.
Like wherever your mom lived, basically.
From the Finisterre region of Britain. There might be something to that name. But yes, I am absolutely Pierre Rochard.
I'm Francis Puglia. And today was Swan live.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll wrap there. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
On behalf of the Swan team, thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal podcast. You should join us live next time. If you weren't able to on this one, jump into our Swan Signal Telegram chat room. We have a lively crew in there chatting during our conversation and asking questions of our guests. It's a lot of fun. You can find that chat at t.me/SwanSignal. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to buy Bitcoin. We have easy setup of automatic buys. We're focused on stacking sats, not trading. No altcoin distractions. We're forever Bitcoin only. There are automatic withdrawals to your Bitcoin wallet. We're committed to Bitcoin education. Follow us on Twitter at SwanBitcoin and subscribe to the podcast at swansignalpodcast.com. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining us.